Good afternoon. My name is Ann Cavall, and on behalf of the Breast Cancer Education Association Board and volunteers, I welcome you to the BCA webinar education series. I encourage you to grab a pen and paper, as there will be plenty of good information shared in the next hour. We do have participants joining us in two ways, via webcast or by phone. For those connected via webcast, please follow along with the slideshow on your screen. Also, for those connected via the webcast, you should see a box to the left of the slides where you will be able to submit questions during the Q&A portion near the end of the session, and really feel free to submit them throughout the presentation as well, and I will ask them as time allows. This year, the BCEA continues to expand their mission, providing frequent breast cancer educational resources that are easy to access. This year's educational programming promises to encourage, empower, and engage our community in a variety of ways, including webinars such as this one offered throughout the year, our signature education-focused fall conference that will be held on Saturday, October 7, 2017, at the TIES Conference Center in St. Paul, that's near the state fairgrounds, and through increased ongoing resources on our website and social media channels available 24/7. If you are unable to attend any of our previous webinars, recordings of these sessions are available on the BCEA website at www.breastcancereducation.org under the webinar tab. This is a great way to easily access valuable information at your convenience. We also invite you to join us for a little fun and participate in at least one of a couple fundraisers coming up, the first of which is a BCA paint and sip event on Sunday, August 20th at Cheers Pablo in Woodbury, or also at the Shulock Breastfest Music Festival on September 16th in Corcoran. Both are opportunities to have fun and support a great cause. If you have not done so already yet, please be sure to connect with us on social media. We regularly share and foster discussion on the latest news and resources in breast cancer detection, diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship. We also encourage you to share what you learned today using the hashtag BCEAWebinar. Please also be sure to keep your eye out for more information on our next webinar set for August 22nd, 2017. On reconstruction. Other 2017 webinar dates are set for November and December, and we will continue to share specific information on upcoming webinars as soon as complete details are available. And now I'd like to introduce the speakers for today's webinar. Dr. Michaela Tsai graduated from Harvard Medical School and completed her internal medicine residency at the University of Minnesota. In her work at Minnesota Oncology, she focuses on special interests, including breast cancer, clinical research, and hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndromes. She completed combined internal medicine and the pediatrics residency training at the University of Minnesota in 2002, and then a fellowship in hematology and medical oncology at the University of Minnesota in 2005. And is board certified in hematology and medical oncology. Katie Hauslog, RN, completed her undergraduate and graduate degrees from Winona State University. Katie began her career with Minnesota Oncology as a research nurse and joined as a nurse practitioner in 2008. Katie has special interests in oncofertility, sexual health, and survivorship. She sees patients throughout their cancer journey. Dr. Colleen Casey is a reproductive endocrinologist, fertility specialist at the Center for Reproductive Medicine. She received her medical degree from the University of Minnesota and completed her residency at the University of Michigan. She is board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, reproductive endocrinology, and infertility. Welcome, Michaela, Katie, and Colleen.
Thank you. This is Dr. Michaela Tsai. I'm going to get us started off today. I am a medical oncologist with Minnesota Oncology, and I work at Abbott Northwestern and the Piper Breast Center. My practice primarily includes women with breast cancer and those with hematologic malignancies. And interestingly, these are the two groups that are probably most affected by infertility as a result of their diagnosis or treatment. I'm also a BRCA mutation carrier and a mother of two children thanks to assisted reproductive technology. So this is a topic that's really important to me, both personally and professionally. So a few things we'd like to talk about today. First of all, why this subject is so important. Second, how and why fertility might be affected by cancer and cancer treatment. Third, the probability that a cancer diagnosis or cancer treatment will impact fertility. Next, who and what resources are available. And finally, some future directions. So when a woman is first diagnosed with breast cancer, really what she's most focused about is her survival. Will she actually survive her cancer? Fortunately, most women these days actually do quite well and do survive. However, this might require extensive treatment, surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, hormones, or some combination of all of those things. And this certainly can take its toll mentally and physically and emotionally, both in the short term and the long term. We're better now at recognizing this and taking proactive measures to help eliminate some of this distress. But one of the most distressing things for a young woman with cancer who may not have children yet is whether she will be able to have children in the future. We know that parenthood is a normal part of a happy, healthy life, and cancer survivors are often fearful that their cancer or its treatment will have an adverse impact on their future children. They're also concerned about risks of cancer recurrence, miscarriage, and future successful pregnancies. So we know, unfortunately, that only about half of patients receive information about infertility or impact of cancer treatment on their fertility when they're first diagnosed. But studies have shown that almost everybody wishes they had heard about this and heard about it sooner. So we're really trying to make sure we do that. We also know that women are referred less frequently to fertility specialists than men are. But the quality of life of all cancer patients is improved if we do talk about this and make appropriate referrals early and often. And this is not only recognized here, but is really recognized nationally and worldwide. So the NCCN is the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. This is a group of 20 or so of the top academic cancer research centers in the U.S., and they meet a few times a year and come up with guidelines. So they actually have guidelines to talk about fertility in adolescent and young adult oncology patients, talking about fertility preservation as well as sexual health, and again, highlighting the importance of early referral to a specialist to discuss options such as embryo or oocyte cryopreservation. ASCO is the American Society of Clinical Oncology. They also have a nice algorithm. You know, as soon as a patient is diagnosed with cancer, we develop a treatment plan. And if that treatment plan could impact someone's fertility, we should talk about it and see whether they want to have children in the future. And if so, again, we should talk about options and get them referred to a specialist as soon as we can. This seems like a no-brainer, pretty straightforward, but surprisingly, it's not talked about as often as it needs to be. Here in Minneapolis, we actually see a fair number of young women with cancer. If we look back at 2015, we had 71 women under the age of 45 diagnosed with breast cancer. That's approximately 6 per month. And I know personally in the last week I saw 3 young women in their early 20s with breast cancer. So this is definitely something we see commonly and unfortunately increasingly commonly. We here at Minnesota Oncology have actually partnered with Align Health and the Center for Reproductive Medicine, and we've come up with a program and information that we disseminate to all young women newly diagnosed with breast cancer. It includes information about what fertility preservation is, where to go, who to call, how much this might cost. And we have a phone number that they can call a new patient scheduler and usually have an appointment within 24 to 48 hours if that's what they want. I would say, unfortunately, that cost remains still the greatest barrier. So why does cancer treatment impact fertility? Well, the risk of infertility really depends on a number of factors: the type and the stage of cancer, the chemotherapy drugs and the doses of those drugs given, whether they receive radiation, and if so, the number of treatments and the cumulative dose. The extent of surgery involved can also have an impact. One's age at the time of diagnosis is really important. The closer a woman is to natural menopause, the more likely it is that she will suffer infertility. Genetic factors can come in as well. Genetics regarding, you know, how old your mother was when she went into menopause, but even things like BRCA mutations. We know that women who carry BRCA mutations, their oocytes, their eggs, might be more sensitive to the toxic effects of chemotherapy than other people. We know that if you do go into menopause with chemotherapy, this could be temporary, but unfortunately could also be permanent. Most women do regain menstrual cycles within 6 months. Sometimes it takes longer, but unfortunately, if you go more than a year, it's unlikely that you will regain normal menstrual function. Again, we know that the type of treatment you receive is really important. Here on this graph, we see the bottom line with the open circles. Those are women who maybe had surgery only and didn't need any chemotherapy or hormone therapy. They're likely to go into menopause at a natural age, 50 plus or minus a few years. The second line is if you get endocrine therapy only, and in young women that's typically tamoxifen, that is less likely to cause fertility problems. The next line is chemotherapy only, and the top line is if you get both chemotherapy and endocrine therapy. Unfortunately, there's a much greater likelihood that that will cause permanent menopause. And again, the older you are, the more likely that is to be a problem. It's also important to consider what drugs you're receiving. We know that some drugs are more likely to cause issues than others, particularly Cytoxan, which unfortunately is common to most of our breast cancer chemotherapy regimens, can cause problems. I'll highlight the ACT regimen. That's probably our most commonly used chemotherapy regimen in young women. If you get this when you're in your 20s, there's maybe a 10% chance of permanent menopause. That's not so bad. But if you're 40, the likelihood is more like 70%, which is really quite high. So it's important to talk about these things with your oncologist when making decisions about fertility preservation. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Katie.
Hi, it's Katie Hauslog. I'm one of the nurse practitioners. I often work with Dr. Tsai at our Minneapolis office. And thanks for having us here and talk about this really important topic. So just briefly want to talk about different options. This will probably be the only time I talk about men, but worth mentioning that with fertility, sperm banking is probably the most common technique used. And as Dr. Tsai referred to, certainly men are referred much more frequently than women for reproductive counseling and therapy. Radiation shielding in the gonads can happen for both men and women, and testicular sperm extraction can happen, donor sperm, and certainly adoption for the men. For women, embryo freezing, and also add to that should be egg freezing. So radiation shielding, again, because we know the follicles are so sensitive to DNA damage, that can really be affected from radiation and decrease follicle numbers. So shielding is important. Transporting the ovaries can happen surgically. Success rates have been pretty variable with that, down to 16% and as high as 90% in some. Removing the cervix in someone who has a cervical cancer. Donor embryos or donor eggs, surrogacy and adoption, certainly. And it does require individually sort of talking with patient and families and exploring with your healthcare provider the best situation and best choices for you. So we've put together a couple of case studies. The first is a young woman who's 34 years old, and in January 2014, she was diagnosed with a stage 1A breast cancer, which was estrogen and progesterone receptor positive and HER2 negative. She had angiolymphatic invasion at the time of surgery. She saw reproductive medicine initially up front, as she greatly desired to preserve her fertility and maintain her fertility as she could. She did embryo collection before she started chemotherapy. And we gave her 4 cycles of taxotere Cytoxan that was given every 3 weeks for 4 cycles. At the end of therapy, the recommendation was to take hormonal therapy or endocrine therapy for a couple of years before becoming pregnant. I would add to that that traditionally then there's a washout period of about 3 months after someone would stop tamoxifen before we would feel comfortable saying it would be okay for you to move forward and try to get pregnant. Because she had the embryo preserved, we could move forward. And she had a little bit less than 2 years, I believe, of taking tamoxifen at that time. And in October, or in 2016, then she delivered a healthy baby boy. So a couple of comments on her particular case. As Dr. Tsai alluded to, Cytoxan certainly can be very tough on ovarian function. That seems to be very dose dependent. In this particular case, she would have got, just over 2 grams of Cytoxan total dose, and it seems to be at sort of the 5 gram mark that can be much more significant, and certainly a woman who's over 40 that gets 5 grams or more is at much higher risk than, say, someone who's maybe in their 30s or even 20s that gets that same dose. Then taxanes can decrease amenorrhea, and, we have to be careful somewhat and say that, return of menses does not necessarily equal fertility, but certainly is helpful in us looking at the big picture. A couple kind of big takeaway points is that pregnancy after cancer actually does not at all increase risk of recurrence, and that's regardless of estrogen receptor status, if it's positive or negative. And there's been several large studies that have really confirmed this. And in fact, pregnancy after breast cancer may almost have this protective effect, which is also often referred to in literature as the healthy mother effect. So there's no evidence that history of cancer, treatment of cancer, fertility interventions impact risk of recurrence or damage to the baby either. So that's all really great and really positive things that we can see when we look at fertility and having babies after someone is affected by cancer. Radiation to the breast doesn't seem to impact fertility but can decrease lactation. In some of the literature, it's not even advised. So it would be, again, an individualized conversation because of the risk of mastitis can be really difficult to treat. So something to consider, certainly. GnRH agonist is a topic of conversation. These include gasserolin and lupron. It's a hormonal manipulation to suppress ovarian function, and it would sort of quiet one's ovaries to induce sort of a menopausal-like state. Hot flashes and headaches can certainly be side effects, and sometimes insurance can be a little bit problematic when you're looking at this. There's been 2 really great studies, one called the POEMS trial and the second called the PROMISE trial. And both of these studies showed that when you can use GnRH agonists, it seems to decrease risk of post-chemotherapy ovarian failure. So in the POEMS trial, it was 8 versus 22%. So 8% of women experienced post-chemotherapy ovarian failure versus 22%. 8% with the GnRH agonist. And then the PROMISE trial was 8.9 versus 25.9%. And the more pregnancies did seem to successfully, according to the POEMS trial, were successful, 21 versus 11% when one used the GnRH agonist. So the trials really support the use, and I think we have good data, but certainly ongoing studies exist. So if we want to look at a second case, FN was a 27-year-old female. She had a stage 2A Hodgkin disease. She was treated with ABVD, which is a typical chemotherapy we use for Hodgkin's. She was treated with radiation. She started Gasserolin the week before chemotherapy. She didn't do any embryo preservation. That was not something that she could do at that time. And just, you know, on her own, she was able to get pregnant in 2010 and had a healthy baby girl. I've collected a list of resources here. I think LiveStrong and Fertile Hope are really great resources. On the first website, livestrong.org/fertilehope, there's a fertility risk tool calculator there, which I found to be very helpful. SaveMyFertility.org has great patient and provider information. MyOncoFertility.org is the OncoFertility Consortium out of Northwestern. And Reproductive Medicine site is on here, the Society of Reproductive Medicine, and a nice booklet on cancer and fertility on the bottom of the list there, which is from Fertile Hope. On the left side of your screen, you see different financial resources. Some facilities or some organizations have been able to provide some financial assistance for women, couples, families going through this, and certainly worth checking into. Even some organizations have provided discounted drugs as well.
So Katie, let me interrupt for a second there. So what are some of the costs associated with IVF?
Yeah, I think Dr. Casey probably has some information on that.
Perfect. Okay.
Yes, I'll present that during my portion.
Perfect.
Of it.
That'd be great. Thank you. So there was just a couple of months ago, ASCO, the American Society of Clinical Oncology had its annual meeting. And there was a great presentation there that showed that it is very safe, and long-term follow-up really does confirm that pregnancy is safe, and providers and your healthcare team should not discourage that, regardless of estrogen receptor status. So that was really great to be able to sort of see that. Now, there's two different trials that are currently being looked at, and on the previous slide, they alluded to this too. So the positive trial on the top left there is looking at interrupting endocrine therapy. So after a woman has been treated maybe with chemotherapy, maybe radiation, or maybe not, either of those things, and doing endocrine therapy, likely tamoxifen at that time. And so the study is looking at stopping endocrine therapy and looking at the breast cancer-free interval. And letting women try to get pregnant, looking at return of menses, pregnancy rate, outcomes, offspring outcomes, breastfeeding patterns, and how many of them needed reproductive technology assistance, as well as kind of looking at distant recurrence-free interval, certainly, too. So this is a really great trial. It'll be really exciting to see what this shows and just reiterate, I think, what we already know and have a good idea about. The second trial, this E1Q11, is a study looking at education for healthcare providers as well as patients. There's some quality of life tools associated with that, and looking at improving the understanding of reproductive risks that starts when someone is diagnosed, and the patients would enroll on that for 5 years. And I think they're enrolling over 500 women. That one is not specific to breast cancer. So just to sort of conclude, Dr. Tsai, in my portion, I think the big takeaway parts is to talk to your healthcare team and talk to your physician, talk to your nurse practitioner about what are your risks and be able to have a conversation, utilize the resources that we know are available, consider seeing reproductive endocrinology, you know, upfront or when you're done with therapy, AMH levels, Dr. Casey will talk a little bit more about, and looking at Zoladex or Lupron to help sort of quiet down those ovaries and make some decisions afterwards about how you and your family, your partner decide to wish to move forward.
Well, thank you, Katie and Dr. Tsai. That was fantastic. Really good information. I appreciate all of the data that you presented today. I'm Dr. Casey. I'm at the Center for Reproductive Medicine, just kitty corner from Abbott Hospital. And what this portion of the talk is going to discuss is basically how we get the eggs, the process of getting eggs, because that's mostly what we do in our clinic. I'll briefly touch on ovarian tissue cryopreservation, as that's another method of ovarian preservation. And Katie did a great job talking about ovarian suppression today as well. So let's focus for a brief time on egg freezing or oocyte cryopreservation. So egg freezing allows for greater control of disposition of individuals' gametes in the future. We offer both egg freezing and embryo freezing at the Center for Reproductive Medicine, but for many young women, they may not be with their future partner at the time when they want to preserve their fertility. The other thing to really take into consideration is this is no longer considered experimental. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine stated in 2013 that due to advances in technology, such as vitrification to freeze the eggs, that this is no longer experimental and can be offered to anyone, whether they have a cancer diagnosis or if they want to preserve their fertility. So here's the egg right here. Nice picture of the egg. This is a mature egg, and it's one of the largest cells in mammals. It has a high surface volume ratio, so that was part of the challenge in freezing eggs. It has low permeability to water and has a short lifespan if not fertilized within a couple hours. So in the past, it's been very challenging to freeze eggs because of all of these factors, especially with the formation of ice crystals that happens when you slow freeze. The egg's really vulnerable. The outer shell of the egg is called the zona pellucida, and that hardens when frozen in the traditional slow freeze method. It may activate the egg and make the egg no longer viable. The important thing, too, is the alignment of the chromosomes in order when fertilization happens for a normal chromosome embryo to develop, and the ice crystals can misalign the chromosomes. So vitrification essentially took that away and is a wonderful way to be able to freeze eggs and embryos. Here's my group right here. There's five physicians. We all see oncofertility patients when they contact our clinic. And Sue Hemme is a nurse practitioner. She works in the St. Paul office, but she's the go-to person, first contact, and facilitates the care between the oncologist, nurse practitioner, and reproductive endocrinologist. So she gets the story. She encourages the patient to call Dar, who's our new patient coordinator. And as Dr. Tsai said, we really try to see the patient within 24 to 48 hours of the contact. The process is pretty complex, so we really needed to get a good protocol in place. The first step is with a consultation with one of the five of us, of the physicians. We'll often do an ovarian reserve assessment, and I'll talk about that in a couple minutes here. The FDA requires that we do STD screening for any tissue that we freeze, so when we freeze eggs, we just need to get a blood test. It's a couple hundred dollars and is often covered by insurance. The patient will then meet with the nurse to go through timeline, medications, how to administer shots, and just walk through the whole process. So this first appointment really can turn out to be half of a day. They'll then meet with a financial consultant. Stephanie and Leanna are our two go-to people here. What they will do is go through the insurance benefits, so within a couple minutes, the patient will know how much coverage she has. It is, in Minnesota, pretty rare to have good coverage for fertility preservation, although some companies are getting better about how they are allowing patients or their employees to have benefits. But the total cost for egg freezing is about $9,140, and that's two start the process all the way through the eggs being frozen and stored for the first year. The medications can be pricey, but a lot of times we can get the drug companies to help out pretty significantly with the medication. Traditionally, it's about $3,000, but usually we can offset most of that cost by drug donation from certain companies of the drug providers. We do have a couple mental health specialists that we work with who can meet with the patient as well to kind of discuss whether she wants to freeze eggs, embryos, whether she really wants to do this, talk about future options if she chooses not to do this. And then the final point here is that Some women are married, and we have more experience with embryo freezing than we do with egg freezing. We just don't have as much data on success rates with eggs. So if that's the case and she wants to freeze her embryos with her husband or partner, we would do a male factor assessment, which I'll talk about in just a couple minutes as well. So back to ovarian reserve testing. You can see on the right here is a picture of a female reproductive system. The bottom is vagina, cervix, up to the uterus, and then the tubes come off on either side. Ovaries sit right underneath the tubes there. So as women, we are born with all of the eggs that we'll ever have. And every month, when we are in our reproductive years, basically we recruit a certain number of follicles, a very small portion of what's left. And of those follicles, one of those gets stimulated each cycle to produce an egg inside that follicle, which is essentially an egg sac. When the beginning of the cycle happens and all of those follicles are recruited, they secrete a hormone called anti-Müllerian hormone, or AMH. This is a direct correlation to ovarian reserve, and ideally, we want the value to be above 1. This test is just a blood test anytime during her cycle, even if she's already started medication for her treatment. But basically, it's a good marker of ovarian reserve. The cost is usually covered by insurance, but it's anywhere from $75 to $145. An antral follicle count is an ultrasound looking at the ovaries to see how many follicles are recruited, because we can visualize that on ultrasound. The average that we would want to see for women depends on age, but ideally we would love to see greater than 10 to 20. Now that ultrasound would cost about $315, but again is usually covered by insurance since it is a diagnostic test. And we know the natural decline of fertility with age as well. So those three factors really will help determine how we think she is going to respond to medication to stimulate multiple eggs to develop. So how many eggs should we get? This was a great study done and presented at the our national meeting back in October last year. Dr. Goldman basically looked at multiple cases and found that there is a correlation to how many eggs and success of basically of getting pregnant in the future and how it correlates to age. But you can see here for women that are 35, if we get 10 eggs, she has about a 50% chance in the future of having a baby from that cycle. If we get 40, it's up to 94%. You can see here once women are 40, 42, 44, that the success rates, no matter how many eggs we get, goes down. And that's just a product of female reproductive aging. But some patients have time to do more than one cycle, so it's nice to kind of give women a realistic idea of what her future success is going to be based on our technology as it stands today. All right, so male testing. Say the patient has decided to freeze her embryos. Often we'll do a test to determine route of fertilization. It's called a sperm penetration assay test. It's basically a fancy semen analysis. He would just have to collect a sample. And then that determines whether we do microdroplet versus ICSI. And I'll show you a picture of this later on, but essentially microdroplet is where the embryologist prepares 100,000 motile sperm and drops that droplet on the egg, hoping in the next 24 hours a sperm is going to get into the egg and fertilization is going to be complete. ICSI is where we take one sperm and literally inject it into the egg, and I'll show you that in just a moment. The process itself is pretty straightforward. Basically, the goal is to do two things. One is to stimulate as many follicles to develop eggs as we can. In a natural cycle, a woman's only going to produce one or maybe two follicles that contain eggs. With this, we're going to try to get as much of that cohort, those 10 to 20 that we saw, and stimulate them with gonadotropins, which are FSH that goes directly to the ovaries to stimulate the follicles to grow. The second thing we have to accomplish is to prevent ovulation, and that's downregulation. We do that with either a low-dose Lupron or the antagonist, and I'll show you kind of how that works in a couple slides here. The egg retrieval itself is very straightforward. It's done right in the back, about 20 feet from my office. It's done under conscious sedation. We have two nurse anesthetists on staff. They will put the patient to sleep, and then we do the retrieval. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes. And then fertilization usually takes place a couple hours after the egg retrieval itself. So in a traditional situation, the process of IVF takes anywhere from 5 to 7 weeks. How it works, just so you get a sense of how the protocols will be different for women that are trying to expedite this because of chemotherapy coming up. But when a woman gets her period at the top there, she would start birth control pills from anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks. The medication to prevent ovulation, called Lupron, is started and overlaps while she's on birth control pills. 10 days into the Lupron, she comes in for an ultrasound. Estradiol level, things should be quiet because her ovaries have been suppressed by the pills and the Lupron. Then she starts gonadotropin injections, twice a day, really, for 7 to 12 days. And we monitor the cycle to see how she responds. Vaginal ultrasounds and estradiol levels give us an idea of how well she's going to respond. In a natural cycle, estradiol levels peak around 300. With IVF and egg stimulation here, it can be anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000, so it's pretty robust. As the follicles grow and become mature, when the majority are mature, 15 millimeters or above, she will take one last injection of HCG, which mimics LH, the hormone that causes ovulation. But what LH and HCG also do are mature the eggs, because we know immature eggs will never fertilize. So that's done, and then prior to when she would ovulate, 36 hours after HCG injection, the retrieval takes place. Here's just a picture looking at how the egg retrieval happens. There's a vaginal ultrasound on the top, kind of middle part of the slide here, and the ovaries are on either side. The ovaries are easy to see when they're stimulated because those follicles look like big little black circles, kind of like a chocolate chip cookie, and basically, the needle goes into the ovary, attached to suction, and each follicle is then aspirated, and the egg is floating around somewhere into that follicle. The fluid gets collected into the vial and handed back to the embryologist. So it's a very quick procedure. We know the number of eggs prior to her leaving. She usually recovers for about a half hour and back to normal activity the next day. So we know with everything, you know, is it safe to get pregnant with this? These studies are really looking like, you know, it is okay for women with history of breast cancer to get pregnant. What happens during stimulation, though, because the estradiol levels get so high? 1,500 to 3,000 is a really high estradiol level. We know that estrogen can stimulate breast cell proliferation, and the levels that are achieved in IVF have been shown to have a proliferative effect in vitro. Now, how we've circumvented this is there's a different medication that stimulates the ovaries called letrozole. And how letrozole acts is decreases estradiol levels. So this is perfect for women that we're trying to get her ovaries to stimulate, but we want to keep estradiol levels low. So what we have adopted for all patients with breast cancer is to do a combination of letrozole along with the FSH gonadotropins. This study just basically here, I didn't summarize everything, but the purpose of the study was to determine whether this works. And what they found is that the estradiol levels in the study with letrozole were actually pretty good, pretty close to what they are in a natural cycle. And I really have seen that here too, and we've had patients on both letrozole and the FSH injections. The number of eggs that were frozen and vitrified means frozen, and the dose of gonadotropins weren't any different between the two groups. So this really is pro-letrozole, that this is really a good option for women that we want to keep their estradiol levels nice and low throughout this process without sacrificing the number of eggs or the amount of medication they need to stimulate their ovaries. So I'm just going to briefly go through the different protocols that we do for patients. I think the important part of this is time to retrieval because a lot of these women are needing to move forward quickly with chemotherapy. The first one is kind of the traditional one, the Lupron protocol, 20 to 31 days. This is a woman who has time to be able to do the cycle. What we get is we get a mid-luteal progesterone level that should be high, and she starts the Lupron for 10 days. She'll come in for the baseline ultrasound, start letrozole and gonadotropins, same sort of monitoring that I talked about before, HCG, and then the retrieval. Then she starts the letrozole, ideally before her next cycle. that just really maintains a low estradiol level. And a lot of patients move to chemotherapy and we don't do that second part of letrozole, and it seems to be fine. But if we can, we will. Another protocol is called an antagonist protocol. Two phases of a woman's cycle. There's the follicular phase, which is before ovulation, and there's the luteal phase, that's after ovulation. This is kind of the easiest situation. So she comes in, she gets her period, she comes in on day 3, she starts letrozole for 2 days and then starts the injections, do the monitoring. When her lead follicle reaches 14 millimeters, we need to stop premature ovulation, and Ganirelix, or the antagon is what it's called most commonly, is taken once a day to prevent ovulation through the day of HCG and the retrieval. Now you can see here the time to retrieval is significantly less, 10 to 14 days. I think our record here is 8 days from start to finish. Another option, if she's in the luteal phase, is to shut down her cycle so we can get her to the beginning of her cycle again. So how we can shut down a cycle is giving her the antagonist, which prevents any sort of premature ovulation or whatnot. She takes the Ganirelix for 4 days, comes in for the ultrasound, starts stimulation the same way everyone else has been doing it. Still, we want to prevent ovulation towards the end of her stimulation there, and she gets the HCG in retrieval. And that's a little bit longer because of the Ganirelix. There's more data now coming out that you really can start women anytime without completely shutting them down first. I still kind of feel like if we can get it as close to a natural cycle, that seems to give us the best outcome. And then fertilization, I mentioned for patients that have opted to freeze embryos instead of eggs, we retrieve the eggs, fertilize with either microdroplet or ICSI, and then watch the embryos grow. We know blastocysts are the safest stage to freeze embryos. Survival rate is about 95% once you freeze and thaw them. So we watch the embryos as they grow. Day 2, we're looking at about 4 cells. Day 3, we're looking at about 8 cells. But by day 5, we're looking at about 120 cells for the blastocyst. So any embryo that makes it to the blastocyst day 5, 6, or 7 will be frozen. Another technology we can take advantage of for patients that are interested is something called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, as well as screening. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is a way to test the embryo for a known mutation of a certain gene. BRCA1 and BRCA2 are a good example of this. What we do is the embryos develop to the stage of the blastocyst, and we actually biopsy some of the cells, freeze the embryo, send the cells to be tested, and then wait for the results to only hold on to the embryos that are normal. At the same time, they'll check to see what the chromosome makeup is of the embryo. We know chromosomally normal embryos implant more often, but also miscarry less often. And a chromosomal abnormality is the number one reason why women have miscarriages. So here's a picture of PGD. It's a trophoblast biopsy. The embryo itself is the inner cell mass, which is a tiny piece inside the embryo. The trophectoderm are the multiple cells that are on the outside. The embryologist can identify the trophectoderm cells, biopsy 4 to 8 of them of the 120, freeze the embryo, send the cells to, we work with Natera most often, they're in California, 7 to 10 days after they run the test, they will give us a report of which embryos are normal and which ones are abnormal. So we know which embryos to use in the future and which ones should be discarded. And, you know, some patients don't necessarily discard the embryos if it's a non-fatal sort of mutation. We don't automatically discard them, but it's up to the patient if they want to or not. Just a quick bit about radiation therapy. This has already been touched on, but if there's radiation to the pelvis or the brain, that can affect the reproductive system. I'll talk briefly about ovarian tissue, cryopreservation. We don't do this at our center. Mayo does it, and I'm thinking that Rachel Miller she's an adolescent gynecologist. I think she's starting up at Children's Hospital offering this. I'm not sure where that's at. But basically, this is a way to preserve thousands of ovarian follicles at once, not just one cycle of IVF. So basically, the cortical, the outer part of the ovary, is where all the follicles are. So the best candidates would be women that aren't, or girls that aren't cycling yet, or if they truly can't delay, because this is a one-day procedure versus multiple days of stimulation and retrieving. Basically, take the cortical tissue prior to chemo or radiation, dissect the tissue usually into strips and freeze it, and then later putting it back. So ovarian function generally resumes anywhere from 2 to 6 months after the transplant, but lasts for only about 7 years. So it's a tight window in which this could potentially work. And really, they have found women over 40 have not had much success due to the decline in natural fertility. More on the tissue freezing. There aren't any reported pregnancies who froze ovarian tissue prior to puberty. And the other risk is if there's receding tumor cells that are in the ovarian tissue when we freeze and then thaw, basically any sort of metastasized cancer. Leukemia is a good example of this. That's pretty rare, but that's one of the things that should be taken into consideration there. So as of 2014, and I don't think it's changed, but ovarian tissue cryopreservation is still considered to be experimental, but there are many centers throughout the nation and the world that are doing this on a regular basis under IRB approval. Ovarian suppression was well described earlier in the talk, so I'm not going to talk about that right now. But just to summarize, egg and embryo freezing are no longer considered experimental. Ovarian tissue freezing is considered experimental, but may be the only option for some young women. ASRM considers the agonist to be experimental, but it sounds like these two studies that Katie mentioned are really looking favorably on this. But other options, and I believe, Katie, you touched on this as well, using donor egg, gestational carrier, and adoption. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
So we do have a few questions. So the first one I will direct to Dr. Casey, is there an age limit to freezing eggs or embryos?
Good question. Our board, which is made up of the five of the physicians, we've discussed this several times, and basically ASRM guidelines say 45, and so we offer through the age of 45. So we'll see all the patients, we'll do an ovarian reserve assessment, and then just really have a frank conversation with the patient if this makes sense to do or not. But we certainly offer it to all patients through their 45th birthday.
Thank you. And is it better to freeze eggs or embryos?
That's a great question. I think we have more experience and we have more data on success rates with freezing embryos. So if the patient's in a situation where she, you know, is married or is with a committed partner, you know, I tell her that we have more experience with freezing embryos. But I also don't want to take away the freedom of her being able to freeze the eggs if her life would change down the road.
And then how many patients do you see that return to use their eggs or embryos?
Good question. You know, we've just started doing this probably on a regular basis within the last 5 years or so. So, you know, a lot of these patients are on medication for a long time. You know, and that may change as the spirit changes, where we think that these women can get pregnant sooner than we thought. But, you know, nationally, the data supports that it's really low. It's about 10% of patients that actually come back. And these are all comers, whether it's fertility preservation for cancer or fertility preservation just for patients that aren't ready to start parenthood.
Thank you. And then, Dr. Tsai, we're wondering whether there is a higher risk of birth defects in children born to mothers previously treated with chemotherapy.
There is not. You know, as if a woman has completed her chemotherapy and is a year or two out, there's absolutely no evidence that prior chemotherapy can harm the baby. In fact, we give women who get breast cancer during pregnancy chemotherapy, as long as they're past their first trimester, and it's safe to give to the mom, and it's safe actually for the baby to receive chemotherapy in utero as long as we're in the second or third trimester. So as shocking as it may seem, it is actually very safe
Well, thank you all so very much. Just thank you, Dr. Tsai, Dr. Casey, and Nurse Practitioner Katie, and to everyone for joining us today. Again, please share what you learned today via our social media channels, and please plan to join us for the next webinar on August 22nd and at our annual education conference on Saturday, October 7th. Thank you.
Thank you.